A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about something we touched on in our UN episodes. The architects of the United Nations saw it as a better alternative to world government, which nobody wanted. But that raises the obvious question. Has anyone actually seriously proposed a unified global state? Not metaphorical citizens of the world. Not regional alliances. Literal planetary government. One flag, one legal system, one tax code for everyone. And if so, did any of these proposals get real traction? And did anyone actually think through how they'd work in practice?
This is one of those questions where the answer is simultaneously yes, extensively, and no, not even close. The world government idea has a surprisingly rich intellectual history, and I don't just mean sci-fi. There have been serious proposals, drafted constitutions, campaigns with real organizational muscle behind them. And then there's the question of why exactly none of them got anywhere.
We're talking about the political equivalent of cold fusion. Lots of theoretical work, some very smart people involved, zero practical implementation.
That's actually a perfect frame because, like cold fusion, the world government idea keeps getting rediscovered by brilliant people who are absolutely convinced they've cracked it this time. Let me give you the landscape. The most serious, fully articulated proposal, and I mean a literal constitution, drafted, debated, ratified by a self-appointed World Constitutional Convention, is the Constitution for the Federation of Earth.
A self-appointed World Constitutional Convention? That's like throwing yourself a surprise birthday party and then acting shocked.
I know, but hear me out. This wasn't a few people in a basement. The World Constitution and Parliament Association was formed in the late 1950s, and they convened actual constituent assemblies. The first one met in 1968 in Interlaken, Switzerland, and Wolfach, Germany. They had over 200 participants from 27 countries. They produced a draft. Then a second session in 1977 in Innsbruck, Austria, refined it. And by 1991, the third session in Troia, Portugal, produced what they called the Constitution for the Federation of Earth.
200 people from 27 countries. That's a nice conference. That is not a constitutional convention.
They'd argue that's exactly what the American Constitutional Convention was. A self-selected group of 55 men in Philadelphia who had no formal mandate from most of the population. The difference, of course, is that the Philadelphia Convention actually had power to enforce its decisions and a population willing to be governed by them. The Earth Constitution folks had neither, but the document itself is fascinating. It's not a vague manifesto. It's a detailed governing blueprint, 20 articles, a world parliament with three houses, a world executive, a world judiciary, a system of global taxation, an enforcement mechanism. They thought through the mechanics.
Three houses of parliament. Most countries can barely manage two without gridlock, and these people want three?
The People's Assembly, the House of Nations, and the House of Councillors. The People's Assembly would be directly elected by the global population, proportional representation. The House of Nations would give each nation equal representation regardless of size, so like the UN General Assembly, but with actual legislative power. And the House of Councillors would be appointed by universities, religious institutions, professional bodies, cultural organizations. It was supposed to represent what they called the global commons of knowledge and wisdom.
The House of Councillors. That's the most technocratic thing I've ever heard. We'll let the universities sort it out.
It's very mid-century rationalist, the assumption that expertise and goodwill can transcend politics. But here's what's genuinely interesting. This constitution has actually been ratified by something. The World Constitution and Parliament Association established what they call a provisional world parliament, which has been meeting since 1982. They've passed what they call world legislation on environmental protection, on disarmament, on human rights. It has exactly zero enforcement power, but it exists as an institutional structure.
It's a model UN for adults who never grew out of model UN.
That's harsh, but not entirely unfair. Yet they've managed to get endorsements from a surprising number of actual elected officials over the years. Members of the Indian Parliament, the Philippine Congress, several European legislatures. The late Sir Peter Ustinov was involved. So was the former Secretary General of the Council of Europe. It's not nobody, it's just nobody with enough power to make it real.
That's one proposal. What else is out there?
The second major strand is the Campaign for World Government, which was founded in 1937, right before World War II, which is significant timing. The founders were largely international lawyers and peace activists who watched the League of Nations fail and concluded that anything short of genuine federation was doomed. The key figures were Rosika Schwimmer, who was a Hungarian feminist and peace activist, and Lola Maverick Lloyd, an American pacifist. They were dead serious. They published detailed proposals, they lobbied governments, they had chapters in multiple countries.
1937. So they're watching the world slide into fascism, and their solution is everyone should be under one government. The timing is either perfect or the worst possible moment to make that pitch.
Because on one hand, the catastrophe of World War II made the case for them. Look what happens when sovereign nations are unchecked. On the other hand, the idea of submitting to a single authority was exactly what people were fighting against. The Campaign for World Government actually had a notable moment in 1945 at the San Francisco Conference that created the UN. They sent a delegation. They pushed for the UN Charter to include provisions for eventual world federation. They got precisely nowhere.
The UN's founding moment was also the moment the world government people got told, thanks but no thanks, in the most official way possible.
That pattern repeats. Every time there's a major global institution-building moment, the world federalists show up and get politely ignored. But here's the thing. They keep showing up, and they keep producing detailed plans. The Campaign for World Government eventually evolved into what's now called the World Federalist Movement, which is still active. They've got consultative status at the UN. They've pushed for things like the International Criminal Court and the Responsibility to Protect Doctrine, smaller pieces of the world government vision that actually did get implemented.
Their strategy shifted from, let's do the whole thing at once, to let's build it brick by brick and hope nobody notices.
That's essentially the story of the United Nations Parliamentary Assembly proposal, which is the most currently active version of the world government idea that has any institutional backing. The basic concept is to create a parliamentary body within the UN system, initially as a consultative assembly composed of national parliamentarians, but with the long-term goal of direct election. The campaign for a UN parliamentary assembly was launched in 2007, and it's actually gotten some traction. The European Parliament has endorsed it multiple times. The Pan-African Parliament has supported it. Over 1,500 members of parliament from more than 100 countries have signed on.
Over 1,500 parliamentarians signed on. That sounds impressive, until you realize there are roughly 46,000 national parliamentarians in the world. So we're talking about 3%.
Something like that. But 3% of any population supporting a radical political transformation is not nothing. The point is that this proposal exists. It's detailed. It has institutional backing and is designed to be incremental. Article 109 of the UN Charter allows for charter review conferences. The UNPA campaign argues that establishing a parliamentary body wouldn't even require charter amendment. The General Assembly could do it by resolution, initially as a subsidiary organ.
They found a procedural loophole. That's very on-brand for international lawyers.
And the UNPA proposal is actually quite concrete about how it would work in practice. The initial assembly would have about 800 to 900 members, allocated proportionally by population but with weighted voting to prevent large countries from dominating entirely. It would start as a purely consultative body, no legislative power, but the idea is that over time, as it builds legitimacy, it would acquire more authority. The end game is a genuine world parliament with binding legislative power on global issues.
Who decides which issues are global?
That's the trillion-dollar question, isn't it? The Federalist answer is usually subsidiarity, the principle that decisions should be made at the lowest level possible. So the world government would handle things like climate change, pandemic response, arms control, space governance, internet governance, maybe some aspects of trade and finance. Everything else stays local. But defining that boundary is where every world government proposal eventually hits a wall.
Because one person's global issue requiring coordination is another person's sovereign national prerogative. Climate change is the classic example. It's global in cause and effect, but the policies needed to address it touch every aspect of domestic economic policy.
That's the fundamental tension that no world government proposal has ever resolved. Let me give you another concrete proposal, because there's a third major strand worth discussing. This one comes from an entirely different direction, not peace activists or international lawyers, but economists and technocrats.
So we can optimize this crowd.
The most prominent example is the work of the economist and game theorist Roger Myerson, who won the Nobel Prize in 2007. He's written seriously about world government as a solution to what he calls the moral hazard. Problem in international relations. The idea that national leaders take risks they shouldn't, because the costs of failure are distributed globally, while the benefits of success are concentrated nationally.
The classic externality problem. The same reason your neighbor plays music too loud. They get all the enjoyment, you get all the annoyance.
Myerson's argument is that a world government with taxation power and the ability to enforce contracts would solve this by internalizing those externalities. If you can't externalize the costs of your military adventures or your environmental degradation, you make different decisions. It's a very economist view of politics. Treat the problem as a market failure and design an institution to fix it.
It has the same flaw as most economists design political institutions. It assumes everyone agrees on what the optimal outcome is and just needs the right mechanism to get there.
That's the critique, yes. But the Myerson-style proposals are interesting because they're not starry-eyed idealism. They're cold, hard institutional design. Here's the problem, here's the mechanism, here's why it would work. And they tend to focus on a minimal world state, just enough government to solve the coordination problems, nothing more. No world cultural policy, no world education ministry. Just courts, police, and a tax authority.
The libertarian's world government. A night watchman state at planetary scale.
Which is a fascinating paradox, because most libertarians are deeply hostile to world government in principle. But if you're going to have a government at all, the logic of externalities and public goods suggests it should be at the largest possible scale for problems that are themselves global. The libertarian philosopher Robert Nozick actually grappled with this in Anarchy, State, and Utopia. His argument was that a minimal state could emerge legitimately from voluntary associations, but he never satisfactorily explained why that logic stopped at national borders.
We've got three flavors. The peace activist constitution writers, the incremental parliamentary reformers, and the economist institutional designers. Any of them get close to actual implementation?
None of them. And understanding why is more interesting than the proposals themselves. The first and most obvious obstacle is the national security state. No major power has ever been willing to subordinate its military to a world authority. The United States, China, Russia, India. None of them are handing their nuclear codes to a world parliament. The Constitution for the Federation of Earth actually addresses this. It calls for a world police force and the phased elimination of national militaries. But that's exactly the provision that makes it a non-starter for any state with real power.
We'd like your nukes, please. That's a tough sell.
The second obstacle is representation. This is the problem that sank every world government proposal from the beginning. How do you allocate power in a world parliament? If it's one person, one vote, then India and China dominate, and the entire developed world becomes a permanent minority. If it's weighted by GDP or some other measure, you're enshrining global inequality into the constitutional structure. If it's one nation, one vote, then Nauru gets the same say as Nigeria, which is absurd. There is no weighting scheme that everyone will accept.
The American founders faced a version of this with large states versus small states, and they solved it with the bicameral compromise. But the gap between China and Tuvalu is orders of magnitude larger than the gap between Virginia and Delaware.
The American solution required a shared political identity and a willingness to compromise that simply doesn't exist at the global level. Which brings us to the third obstacle, the demos problem. Democracy presupposes a demos, a people who agree to be governed together. There is no global demos. There's not even agreement on what democracy means. The Chinese Communist Party claims China is a democracy, a whole process, people's democracy. The European Union has its own conception. The American model is different again. A world government would have to either impose one model or somehow accommodate all of them.
Accommodating all of them means you're not actually governing. You're just hosting a conversation.
Which is essentially what the UN General Assembly is. The fourth obstacle is the one that I think is actually the deepest, and it's rarely discussed in the world government literature. It's what you might call the exit problem. In a national federation, if a state or province is deeply unhappy, it can theoretically secede. It's hard, it's often violent, but it's possible. In a world government, there is no exit. Where would you go?
It's the ultimate lock-in. You're a citizen of Earth, and your only alternative is not being a citizen of Earth.
Which makes it fundamentally different from every other government in human history. Even the most oppressive states have borders you can flee across. A world government eliminates that safety valve. That's terrifying to a lot of people, and not irrationally. If the world government becomes tyrannical, there's nowhere to run.
This is why the science fiction treatments of world government are almost always dystopian. It's not just that writers are pessimistic, it's that the structure itself removes the checks that come from competition and exit.
And yet, there's a case to be made that we're already stumbling towards something like world government without anyone having planned it. The international system has developed an extraordinary density of rules, institutions, and enforcement mechanisms that didn't exist a century ago. The World Trade Organization can authorize sanctions. The International Criminal Court can issue arrest warrants for sitting heads of state. The European Union has its own currency, its own parliament, its own court system. The internet is governed by transnational bodies like ICANN that make binding decisions.
We're getting world government through the back door, one technical standards body at a time.
This is the functionalist argument. It says world government won't arrive through a constitutional convention or a dramatic political act. It'll arrive because the problems become so obviously transnational that national governments gradually cede authority to solve them. And one day, we'll look up and realize we've built a global governance system without ever having voted on it.
Which is either reassuring or terrifying, depending on whether you trust the technocrats running the standards bodies.
That brings us to the most recent development in this space that's actually worth noting. With the rise of AI governance as a policy issue, there's been a new wave of serious people. Not fringe activists, but mainstream policy thinkers, arguing that some form of global governance for advanced AI is necessary. The argument is that AI development is an arms race, and arms races end badly without coordination.
The AI safety crowd has rediscovered the world government argument, but dressed it up in new clothes.
They have, and they're more explicit about it than you might expect. I've seen policy papers from think tanks like RAND and the Carnegie Endowment that use phrases like global governance institution with enforcement powers, which is world government in all but name. The difference is that they're sector specific. They don't want a world government for everything, they want a world government for AI. But the institutional logic is the same.
The same problems apply. Who gets to decide what's safe? Who enforces the rules? What happens if China or the United States says no?
The AI governance debate is essentially replaying all the world government arguments from the 1940s, but with a much narrower scope and a much more urgent timeline. And the answers aren't any clearer now than they were then.
To come back to the original question, have serious people proposed world government? Have any of the proposals gained traction? They've gained supporters, they've gained institutional footholds, but they haven't gained power. And have they articulated concrete visions for how it would work? Detailed constitutions, voting schemes, tax systems, enforcement mechanisms. The plans exist. They're just politically impossible.
I'd add one nuance. The plans exist, but they all share a common blind spot, which is that they assume the political will problem can be solved by better institutional design. The Constitution for the Federation of Earth is impressive as a piece of legal drafting, but it doesn't answer the question of why China or the United States would ever agree to be bound by it. And that's not a drafting problem. That's a power problem.
It's the same thing we see with every utopian political project. The blueprint is beautiful. The builders never show up.
Yet I find it hard to be entirely dismissive, because the people who worked on these proposals, Rosika Schwimmer, Lola Maverick Lloyd, the drafters of the Earth Constitution, the UN Parliamentary Assembly campaigners, they weren't naive. Many of them had lived through world wars. They knew exactly how ugly power politics could be. They just believed that the alternative to trying was worse.
There's a quote I came across from Schwimmer. She said something like, "World government is inevitable. The only question is whether it will be achieved by consent or by conquest." That's the real tension underneath all of this. If global coordination is necessary for survival, climate, pandemics, AI, asteroids, whatever, then either we figure out how to do it voluntarily, or someone eventually does it by force.
The history of political unification is not reassuring on that point. Most large-scale political units in history were created by conquest, not by constitutional convention. The Roman Empire, the Chinese empires, the various caliphates, the European colonial empires, all unified by force. The voluntary federations, Switzerland, the United States, the European Union, are the exceptions, not the rule.
The United States required a civil war to settle the question of whether it was actually a single country. And that was a federation of people who shared a language, a broad cultural heritage, and a recent history of fighting together against an external enemy. The idea that we could do the same thing at global scale without similar levels of coercion is...
Let me mention one more proposal that takes a completely different approach, because it's intellectually interesting even though it's even less likely to happen. There's a school of thought called cosmopolitan democracy associated with the political theorist David Held, who died a few years ago. His argument was that we shouldn't try to build a world state, but rather a multi-layered system of overlapping governance, local, national, regional, and global, with democratic accountability at every level and no single supreme authority.
Instead of a world government, a world governance ecosystem. No top, just layers.
Held called it a cosmopolitan democratic order. It's not world government in the sense of a single sovereign. It's more like what the European Union is becoming, but global. Different issues handled at different levels, with democratic representation at each level and constitutional courts to sort out jurisdictional disputes. It's a much more sophisticated vision than the one world state model, and it avoids the demos problem by not requiring a single global political identity.
It still requires everyone to agree on the rules of the game, and it still requires enforcement mechanisms that can override national sovereignty when necessary. The European Union works because its members chose to join and can choose to leave, as Britain demonstrated. A global system with no exit and compulsory jurisdiction is a different animal entirely.
Held's response to that was essentially that we already have no exit from globalization. The interconnectedness is already compulsory. The question is whether we govern it democratically or let it be governed by market forces and power politics. It's a fair point. The choice isn't between world government and national sovereignty. It's between different forms of global governance, some more democratic than others.
That's probably the strongest argument the world federalists have. The status quo isn't a world of sovereign nations freely choosing their own paths. It's a world where powerful nations impose their preferences on weaker ones through economic pressure, military threat, and institutional capture. World government might be a cure worse than the disease, but the disease is real.
This is where the conversation gets uncomfortable for both the advocates and the critics of world government. The advocates have to confront the fact that any institution powerful enough to enforce global rules is also powerful enough to become a global tyranny. The critics have to confront the fact that the absence of such an institution doesn't mean freedom. It means the powerful do what they want and the weak suffer what they must.
The Thucydides option. The strong do what they can. The weak suffer what they must. That's been the default setting of international relations for about 2,500 years, and we haven't found a way out of it yet.
We've found partial ways out. The European Union has essentially eliminated the possibility of war between France and Germany, which is an almost miraculous achievement given their history. The nuclear taboo has held for 80 years. The ban on chemical weapons has mostly held. These are real governance achievements. They're just not world government.
Where does this leave us? The prompt asked whether anyone seriously floated world government and whether they had concrete plans. The answer is yes on both counts. But the real question underneath, the one the prompt is really asking, is whether this is a viable project or a thought experiment.
I think it's neither. It's not viable in the sense of being achievable in any foreseeable future. The obstacles are too fundamental, and there's no political constituency for it anywhere that matters. But it's not just a thought experiment either, because the underlying problems that world government is supposed to solve are real and getting more urgent. Climate change doesn't care about national sovereignty. Neither do pandemics or asteroid impacts or runaway AI.
We're stuck in the gap between the problem and the solution. The problems are global. The solutions require global coordination, but the political will for global coordination doesn't exist because the institutions that could generate it don't exist because the political will doesn't exist. It's a perfect catch. 22.
That's why the incrementalists keep working. The UN Parliamentary Assembly campaign, the World Federalist Movement, the various sector-specific governance initiatives, they're all trying to break the catch, 22, by building institutions that might, over time, generate the political will for stronger institutions. Whether that's a virtuous cycle or a fool's errand depends on your priors.
My priors say that people are more likely to accept global governance when the alternative becomes visibly catastrophic, which means we'll probably get there eventually, but not until after something terrible happens. That's been the pattern historically. The League of Nations after World War I. The United Nations after World War II. The European Union after the devastation of two world wars on European soil.
The pessimistic case for world government is that it'll take a global catastrophe to make it happen. The optimistic case is that we might be smart enough to build it before the catastrophe. Human history suggests the pessimists have the better track record.
Though I'll say this for the World Federalists, they've been remarkably persistent. The Campaign for World Government was founded in 1937. The Earth Constitution process started in the 1960s. The UN Parliamentary Assembly campaign is still active. That's nearly 90 years of organized advocacy for an idea that has never come close to being implemented. You have to respect the commitment.
The World Constitution and Parliament Association still meets. They still pass resolutions. They still have a website and a newsletter and a rotating presidency. It's easy to mock, but these people believe that they're laying the groundwork for something that might take centuries to achieve. They're playing the long game in a way that almost no political movement does.
The political equivalent of building a cathedral. You start knowing you won't live to see it finished.
And cathedrals did get built, so maybe I shouldn't be too dismissive.
Or maybe cathedrals got built because there was a shared religious vision that transcended political boundaries, and we don't have a secular equivalent of that. The World Federalists are essentially trying to build a political cathedral without a god to dedicate it to.
Their god is reason. The Earth Constitution's preamble talks about the unity of the human species and the common destiny of humanity. It's a secular faith, but it's still a faith.
Faith without power is just. A podcast topic.
We've certainly proven that part.
To wrap up the concrete answer, yes, serious people have proposed world government. The Constitution for the Federation of Earth is a fully drafted governing document. The Campaign for World Government and its successors have been advocating for this for nearly a century. The UN Parliamentary Assembly proposal has over 1,500 parliamentary endorsers. The cosmopolitan democracy theorists had developed sophisticated models of multi-layered global governance. None of them have achieved their ultimate goal, and the obstacles, national security, representation, the demos problem, the exit problem, remain unresolved. But the problems driving the conversation aren't going away.
That's the interesting thing. The world government idea keeps resurfacing not because people are naive, but because the logic of global problems pushes toward global solutions. Every time a new transnational crisis emerges, climate, pandemics, AI, cyber warfare, space debris, someone rediscovers the world government argument. The proposals get more sophisticated each time, but the fundamental political obstacle remains the same. Nobody with power wants to give it up, and nobody without power can force them to.
The ultimate coordination problem. Everyone agrees coordination would be better. Nobody agrees on who should coordinate it, and nobody trusts anyone else to do it fairly.
Which is why, if world government ever does happen, it'll probably look nothing like any of the proposals we've discussed. It'll be messy, ad hoc, full of compromises and exceptions and special deals. It'll emerge from crisis rather than design. And it'll be called something else entirely, because world government is political poison. But the function will be the same.
The world government, the Danalt speak its name.
Already happening, piece by piece. We just don't call it that. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The dual number in Slovene, a grammatical form for exactly two of something, persisted long after most other Slavic languages dropped it. But an unintended consequence was that Slovene speakers in the high medieval period developed an unusually precise system for describing land disputes between exactly two neighboring villages, which legal historians now use to reconstruct medieval property boundaries in ways impossible for languages without the dual.
The grammatical structure of Slovene is now an archaeological tool.
Medieval land disputes preserved in verb conjugations. I don't know what to do with that. Thank you to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, you can find more at myweirdprompts.com, where we've got 200 episodes of exactly this kind of thing. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. We'll be back next time with whatever Daniel sends us.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.